Welcome to the Periphery. I'm Alan Elrod. Our guest today is Dr. Kevin Vallier. He is an associate professor of philosophy at Bowling Green State University in Ohio. And there he is also the director of their program in philosophy, politics, economics, and law. He is also part of the Center for Social Norms and Behavioral Dynamics at Penn. But what we're really going to be digging into today is Dr. Vallier's newest book, All the Kingdoms of the World, on Radical Religious Alternatives to Liberalism, which is a really wonderful, in-depth analysis, exploration of Catholic integralism and a kind of rising strain of thought on the Catholic right today that deals with the place of the state and religion, and has quite a lot to do with the themes Pulaski's interested in when it comes to democracy and authoritarianism and liberalism. So I think just to kick off, Dr. Vallier, do you want to lay out a little bit of broadly for people who aren't familiar what Catholic integralism is, and maybe who some of the people, if they don't even know the idea, they might recognize some of the names that are commonly associated with it.
Sure. I find it useful when explaining this because I call it a form of religious anti-liberalism to kind of explain, because integralism's like 200 proof anti-liberalism. So, but I think it's worth sort of setting out how I think about liberalism, how I define integralism, and then who's sort of associated with it. I see for the liberal tradition, which they're attacking, as a series of movements, ideologies, and theories that have kind of four central values: freedom, individual and group freedom. Freedom can be understood in different ways. Equality, at least equality before the law, but maybe further, like economic equality. Toleration of different religions and creeds and so on. And then a kind of conception of society as one where it isn't necessarily a conflict. Right? Politics doesn't have to be war. It can be a system of mutual advantage or harmony of interests. If you're on the market liberal side of things, you see that in the free market. If you're on the left liberal side of things, you see that in democratic deliberation or what have you. But there's a kind of reconciliation that's possible. Integralism pretty much denies all of these categories, rejects the way that most liberals understand them. So it's anti-liberal in that sense. But here's the positive view. The first thing for your listeners to understand, this is extremely what we call theocentric. That is, it's sort of very God-based theory. And I define integralism in terms of three conditions, two of which actually many Christians, Muslims, and Jews could accept. But the third condition is what makes it really radical and striking. So the first view is that God has somehow ordained the state to look after the common good of its members. So that doesn't necessarily mean divine right of kings or anything. God might authorize the people to choose their own leaders in accordance with the constitution that they chose. This isn't strictly speaking incompatible with democracy, but whatever it is, it's not that the sovereignty begins with the people. It has to come from God originally. But I think that's not hard to explain. The second one is even easier to explain, is that God authorizes an ecclesiastical body, a body of clerics or what have you, to govern the church or the community of Muslims or something like that, in accordance with their eternal good. And it's what the sort of the good is in this life and the next. In Catholicism, this is, of course, God authorizing the rule of the Pope and his bishops, who are responsible for the spiritual good of their members and to try to bring in more people through the Great Commission, or that is some kind of proselytization. These are things that many, many, at least a billion people I can see just being, oh, no, that's true. It's this third condition that really changes things. Integralism arise in the medieval period, where the intertwining between church and state is very, very deep, and is very, even at that time, very old. And so the question is not about church-state separation, which had not really even dawned on them. It was rather how the state and the church should be structured with respect to each other. How should they share power? And there were people who thought that the king had tremendous religious and spiritual power. You know, if you're looking in the early Middle Ages, say with Charlemagne, for instance, thought he could call his own church council the Council of Frankfurt that rejected icons. But the Catholic Church, particularly in the High Middle Ages, is concerned to laicize kings, that is, to deprive them of all spiritual authority. So the church is already seeing itself as its own independent institution. It's not governed at all by the monarchy, and is having a superior goal. That is, it's concerned with people's eternal fate and not just their temporal fate. So the church has the nobler end. And what that means concretely is that the church can call on the state to serve its spiritual agenda in certain cases. God does authorize the state directly, say to take care of agriculture or health care, but sometimes what the state does impinges on what the church does. So the church can direct the state, say, to help it control heretics or to help it ban certain kinds of communication or to restrict certain kinds of speech that are deemed threats to the faithful. So the church doesn't, it's not theocracy in the sense that clerics, you know, priests or what have you, are the boss of everything. Rather, the sovereignty is, it's kind of indirect. So the state can call on the church in certain cases. This was classically called the indirect power of the Pope. I call it indirect supernatural sovereignty. That is, the church has an indirect sovereignty in supernatural matters. And so integralism, very briefly then, is three claims: that the divine authorization of the state, the divine authorization of the church, and then the indirect sovereignty of the church. And the result of that ends up being that, you know, there's not a robust doctrine of religious freedom, counter-liberalism. There's not a robust doctrine of the equality of all persons, as there is in liberalism. There's certainly not a doctrine of widespread toleration like there is in liberalism. And there tends to be a pretty sort of Christian, classical Christian perspective on there being a kind of war between the church and Satan. But they politicize it. So it's not just something that Christians accept today, but it's something that has political implications. If the state isn't ruled by the, isn't sanctified by the church, it's going to be run by the other side. So so when I say integralism, it's 200 proof anti-liberalism. It sort of rejects all the main liberal claims, but that's its positive view. It's this, those three theses, the double divine authorization and then the partial subordination of church to state or state to church.
I think it's really,
oh yes. And the prominent figures, I'm sorry.
No,
So, a lot of these folks were somewhat prominent before they got interested in this. So one key figure is, the Harvard Law professor, Adrian Vermeule, who was well known in the field of administrative law in the U.S. For a long time until his conversion to Catholicism around 2016 and his joining up with the integralist movement that existed and coming to lead it in time. There's Sohrab Ahmari, who was the Iranian immigrant who has been on the right in various different respects for a long time, but converted to Catholicism and then a few years later got involved with the integralists. And while he's distanced himself from the term to some degree, he's still kind of in as thick as thieves with the main figures. There's also Patrick Dineen, who was actually not an integralist, but I think has recently adopted the view in the last 3 or 4 years. So those are all figures that you're most likely to have heard of, Vermeule, Ahmari, and Dineen, kind of the main ones.
I wanted to use those people as a jumping off point because I think the way they talk about themselves is interesting in relation to your analysis and description, in the sense of just kind of a keyword that leaps out to me is this distinction between anti-liberal and post-liberal, right? Which is,
yes, good.
They talk about this idea of being post-liberals. And I think that plays into a lot of your other discussion about, well, like, how does this actually come about, right? Because a lot of what they seem like they're describing is, you know, we envision a world that comes by calling themselves post-liberals, they're saying essentially, like, we envision a world that comes after liberalism. Yeah. Although there's a certain degree of ambiguity about, you know, if something comes after liberalism, liberalism has to end.
Yes, that's right.
And there's a certain degree about ambiguity about how that ending comes about, that transition occurs. So I think we could probably jump into that. You know, I'm also the only other person that leaps out to me that I'd be curious for your thoughts on down the line is Gladden Papin, who's also.
Oh, no, of course, I'm happy to talk about him. He's just the least heard of them but he's significant.
Right.
As the organizer, he's the chief organizational mind. And now Viktor Orban hired him to run the Hungarian Institute of Foreign Affairs. bears. And so exactly. There's a way in which he has the most political power of any of the integralists.
Oh, and I'm biased. He's close.
Yeah.
Person who looks at Hungary to like Papen sticks out to me.
Yes.
Most. But yeah, so let's, I mean, you know,
he was involved before all the other names I met, actually, by maybe at least 5 years and maybe longer.
That's fascinating. I'd love to get into even just Papen
sure.
a little bit. But right. But, yeah. You know, digging on that, you know, it is anti-liberal, but they call themselves post-liberals. Yeah. And again, that's.
So let me run the, my distinctions between these things.
Yeah.
So before the integralists rebranded as post-liberals, which is 2 or 3 years ago now, there was a kind of more generic post-liberal movement, particularly like in the US with figures like John, or the UK, like John Milbank, Adrian Pabst, and so on, Rod Dreher to some degree in the US. And they thought, well, liberalism has certain kinds of like errors, like its supposed worship of individual autonomy. But they weren't really clear on what they were for. Like the thought was just like, look, you know, we're not taking on liberalism anymore. There need to be various changes. We're not quite sure exactly what. So I see post-liberals as kind of like criticizing liberal ideas and liberal values, thinking that liberalism will collapse, but not really knowing what comes next. Whereas the anti-liberals are just much more fierce. They're much more clear about what they think the problems with liberalism are, although I think they're not any more accurate than the post-liberals are. But at the same time, you get a much clearer sense of what they're for, even if they're pretty cagey about it when asked. So I think of post-liberals as kind of like mild anti-liberalism. And so those are just how I'm using and define the terms in the book. And so what the integralists mean by post-liberalism is they think liberalism is going to fall. So they even have periodically used the term late liberalism, like the left uses the term late capitalism, just to imply that it's doomed, right? And there is this sense that liberalism is doomed. And I can kind of spin out their story, which is weird, but it's actually kind of interesting.
I'd love for you.
Their view, they see liberalism as more like an active ideology and movement than I can think of a series of movements over the last 300 years that have emphasized certain values in the way that I do. I don't see there as like this one hegemonic liberal force in society. I think it's a lot more diverse and complex than that, even though I've defended a version of liberalism as a set of principles myself. So their view is that liberalism is a kind of elite movement of extremely ascetic, fanatical pursuers of radical freedom from religion and any authority, and a radical doctrine of equality, which does the same. That liberals seek total political hegemony and total control. That their sort of respect for freedom and equality ends whenever it comes to people of faith. That their tendency to obsess over equality and liberation leads them to engage in more and more equalization and more liberation until there's nowhere else to go. And then eventually they run out of steam, they delegitimize themselves in the eyes of the public and collapse. This is, I think, they're imagining a bit like the way that Soviet Marxism collapsed. It made all these claims and promises, none of them came true. It collapsed, and then more moderate, kind of quasi-liberal democratic people take over, at least for a time, before Putin. Vermeule's model is actually a little bit Marxist. So the reason, for instance, that Marx thought capitalism collapsed, one piece of the story, is that there's a falling return to the rate of profit. And so capitalists will pursue new ventures, but they'll get less and less out of it, and they'll become more and more desperate to the point where they are engaged in such dramatic exploitation that the people no longer tolerate it. And then just overthrow things and form the dictatorship of the proletariat. In the same way that I think Vermeule thinks eventually the folk are going to get tired of all of these constant browbeating, these liberations, these equalizations that go against their good sense, and liberalism will collapse. And as long as the integralists are involved in a kind of self-conscious sect that is training people for positions of power, that when liberalism vacates the modern state, because it just like the Russian state didn't die after Marxism, it was ideologically vacated and became subject to new ideological colonization. They're imagining the same thing, say, happening in the United States. Liberalism collapses, modern state does not collapse. And then if they're ready and careful, that then they can co-opt the modern state. So that's kind of what they're imagining in terms of collapse.
I think this is really where maybe, you know, my own region I've grown up in and my own natural background, and even just maybe how Americans, when they think about some of these themes, might more commonly react, which is this is so interesting to me, because I think a lot of times, especially in the national conversation, but also if, you know, I grew up in the evangelical South, people think about Christian nationalism. It's very much an evangelical Protestant phenomenon. But evangelical Protestantism does not have the institutional tools that Catholicism has in the same way for organizing people or for even imposing hierarchy. So I'm really interested in, okay, something sweeps in. What is that? What is that process? What is that the actual integration of integralism? What is that moment?
Yeah. I mean, Christian nationalism is kind of weird because it was the left talking about it. And then some people among evangelicals and like reformed theologians who were in evangelical, broadly speaking, saying, oh, look, let's put some meat on the bones of this thing the left hates. So like Stephen Wolfe's The Case for Christian Nationalism, like, I think is basically that. Like, it's basically like, Christian nationalism is based, actually. So what does it have to say? You know, and really it's stitching together a number of elements of practices in the United States that existed back before the colonies. So it's actually not crazily foreign from the American situation like Catholic integralism is. So at one point, there's just like the public recognition of the true religion, particularly in recognizing the truth of theism. But also kind of recognizing Christianity as true, even though the federal government didn't really do that. Many Christian nationalists think that it did. That's their picture of history. And many of the colonies expressly, of course, and quite vigorously did that, to the point where they would prosecute heretics and things like that. So, you know, Christian nationalists are come in various strengths. Some of them just want the civic, what I call the civic theism of the 50s, where, you know, you put in God we trust on coins and the Ten Commandments are cool and, you know, that kind of stuff. And of course, then you take on the right wing side of the culture war and you ban abortion and so on. But banning abortion doesn't require the Bible to know that it's true. It's just the truth about reason and so on. And then kind of older restrictions on homosexual or same-sex relationships, getting rid of same-sex marriage. And so there's all this kind of social agenda as well. But Christian nationalism isn't an organized movement. It has very few organized intellectuals. They don't have a lot of independent credibility. Stephen Wolfe has done some kind of ethno-nationalist tweeting and stuff that is very kind of unattractive. You don't, there's no Harvard law professor of Christian nationalism. It's much more a series of sentiments. Like if you poll evangelicals and stuff that they want, they'll say some kind of Christian nationalist stuff. So, and even polling, some polling will have like a Christian nationalism index, which I actually think is like not a great measure, but it is nonetheless one that is used. There is no Catholic integralism index because it is an elite phenomenon. So in the same way that there wasn't like a neoconservatism index in the same way, it's like, well, this is a pretty specific group trying to take the reins of power from the top down. So yeah, I think of Christian nationalism, it's a very different kind of thing than Catholic integralism, but I also think that integralism opened the door for it in the same way that Catholic intellectuals on the right have always opened the door for evangelicals over the last 70 years. So evangelicals not caring about abortion to the late 70s and early 80s, but the Catholic conservatives at National Review cared about it from the beginning, like William F. Buckley. And so you've got on the right a kind of Catholic intellectual leadership that isn't really isn't a majority at all among the sort of folk Republicans and conservatives. It's really Catholicism's influence on the right has been primarily at the elite level. And so Catholic integralism, I think, by saying, hey, let's think about what we really want in the culture war, like what would decisive victory be over the left? Like what amazing society could we have if we destroy the woke, right? Then they're kind of imagining, you know, what they think the best regime would be. But the Christian nationalist sentiment is much broader, but it's also much less specific and well organized. But I think there is a connection between the two movements, as I've tried to outline.
Well, let's talk about one of those elites somewhat fascinates me. Let's talk a little bit more about Gladden Pepin, if you want to.
Good. Most people don't want to do that. But yeah, let's do it. Yeah.
If you want to give the sketch a little bit about Gladden Papin and what he's.
Yeah. So he's you know, a Harvard trained political theorist. He was a student of Harding Mansfield's. He's my age, so he's 40 or so. I think he's almost exactly my age. He's been a very traditionalist Catholic for a very long time. He was even defending, I believe, anti-sodomy laws in college. So he's been quite conservative. I could be wrong about that. I'm pretty sure. So he's been quite conservative a very long time, and a Roman Catholic for a very long time. He's very, very smart. I bet him. I've talked to him. But he likes to talk theory, but really what he is a master organizer. And he has been responsible, for instance, when integralism kind of got imported to the U.S. In its newest iteration in around 2013, you know, he was involved early on in the movement discussion. And many of the integralists were politically diverse, and some of them were, you know, kind of conservative economically, although, or centrist rather. There weren't really a lot of laissez-faire people involved, almost any. But there was a left of the integralists as well. Some of the integralists didn't really care about politics. They're more concerned with religious renewal. And what Papin was able to do, and I've interviewed people about this, was basically to politicize the right and organize the right-wing integralists in part as part of the new right after Trump. Many of them were Trump supporters. Papin was a Trump supporter. There were various kinds of exclusion of various other sects of integralism that Papin was involved with early on. But he was one of the ones all my interviews of integralists suggested was central in politicizing integralism and making it a clear planting its flag on the new right, the anti-liberal right. I actually don't know this for sure, but I'm because he was at Harvard, it's interesting to me that he may have been in a position to bring Vermeule in through common connections. I don't know if he's the one who brought Vermeule to integralism. I know that Father Edmund Wallenstein had a lot to do with it, but you know, they know each other, their friends interact. Same thing with Deneen, same thing. You know, Deneen's even called Papin our man in Budapest. So it's important, first of all, to get a grip on, you know, he's this very, very smart guy. He's extremely adamant. He's the hardest core of the integralists, the most certain that it's true, the one who spent the most effort in trying to make it work. And one of the ways he decided early on this would work, and I think it's because his wife was already a Hungarian citizen, and so he was already paying a lot of attention to Hungary and Hungarian politics, and he was quite impressed with Viktor Orban, particularly in Viktor Orban's way of upsetting sort of European elites and being kind of totally unapologetic about it, and his willingness to rule in a kind of culturally Christian way, to really fight the left, and provided a model. First, which the way the left could be defeated through political power, and the second through which like a sort of positive policy agenda for Christian anti-liberals might actually be. And so I think Gladden has been one of those who's kind of really greased the wheels as far as connections between the GOP and Hungary. I know some of the details about that from testimony and interviews. I don't really want to state them all because I don't necessarily have permission to do it. What I can say is he's been instrumental in the normalization of Orbanism within the GOP, but in a kind of upstream way of building some of the first connections and then really encouraging people to think about it. He's running, say, these camps that, you know, in Hungary that bring in, you know, Americans who want to, you know, conservatives who want to avoid or abandon fusionism or textualism about constitutional interpretation or what have you. And now Orban has hired him as the president of the Hungarian Institute of Foreign Affairs, which is a think tank. But it's kind of publicly funded think tank who's has some diplomatic mission, but it's really an ideological mission to kind of build bridges with Americans who have common political commitments and concerns. Now, I've learned that there are groups on the right that are doing a lot more now to like bring in Hungarian diplomats, diplomatic associations and stuff, and have audiences with major Republican figures like DeSantis. I just learned a few weeks ago, actually, that there have been right-wing foundations that brought a Hungarian delegation to speak with DeSantis and have a private audience with him within the last couple of months. Which I can say, because this was pretty openly stated. So, you know, I can't say the extent to which Papin's been involved with this, because the integrals themselves actually they're not really good at alliances, so they have a lot of enemies. But he's been instrumental. People who were early in the game on this were him and Rod Dreher. But Dreher is a kind of one-man show, and he always has been. And Pappen is very much groupish in terms of building groups and coalitions, even if they don't really get along with other groups very well. And so he's a very important power player in ideological circles, and people don't really understand this at all. But I met him at a conference about 10 years ago before he was really involved in this. The integralist movement was to some extent coalescing in the United States in 2013. It had existed longer, some extent in France and the UK before. So that's kind of the role that I see from the interviews that I've done. And so, you know, maybe the people I've interviewed are wrong, but I talked to a lot of them. And so this is what I understand to be the overall story and role of Gladden Pappen. I don't think there's a modern integralist movement without Gladden Pappen.
I find that really fascinating. I'm kind of curious to chase, you know, an idea from you, which is that, you know, there is a little bit of a difference, as is pretty common, I think, in a lot of intellectual movements, and certainly in Catholicism, of the Americans and the Europeans. And I'm curious how Pappen situates, because I think the Americans have a little bit more of a muscular attitude, a little bit more of and so I'm curious how Pappen is situated between the more sort of theoretical endeavor of integralism, which is just sort of thinking about this distant, idealized sort of conceptualization of church and state, versus the much more kind of strategic, muscular Americanist camp.
Yeah. So integralism in its current iteration really got started in England in the mid-2000s, where there are a number of very conservative Catholic intellectuals that are very worried about the collapse of the Catholic Church in Western Europe. They happened on the idea that what was going on is that the church was refusing to act in accordance with its divinely given mission, which was included holding people accountable for sin. And their argument was that you'd get church renewal if the church could remember its history as a kind of heavenly polity, one that holds people accountable for sin, and one whose role was so important that it could actually co-opt the state in part to back its canonical penalties with civil penalties. And so they've been working out this idea, but in the name of church renewal. So if you follow the British integralists like philosopher Thomas Pink or Alan Fimister, or to Father Thomas Crean, what you see pretty clearly in their writings is they're entirely focused on the church and church reform. They don't really care about American politics at all. And their ideas got imported by an American Cistercian monk, Father Edmund Waldstein, who studied Thomas Aquinas College. Both of his parents were theologians. But he, you know, was at his monastery, which I still can't pronounce, in Austria. And Alan Fimister, who I mentioned, had organized a conference in Trumau in 2012, and Waldstein had grown up pretty early on in college thinking that Catholic liberalism, what he calls Whig Thomism, was false. But kind of what stood in his way was the contemporary Catholic Church's teaching on religious liberty, which does seem to sort of be fairly liberal in its orientation. Pink had developed this alternative interpretation of the church's teaching on religious liberty that allowed for a much more robust anti-liberalism. And when Pink was speaking in Trumau in 2012, this was one of the first times that Father Waldstein had encountered Pink's view. And he sort of put together that, oh, wow, I can be obedient to the church. I can be a loyal son and daughter to the church, unlike many of my traditionalist brethren. And I can also reject liberalism root and branch. So he starts to build sort of social media groups, interacting with people he'd known from college, them having connections with young Catholic intellectuals that, you know, been trained in the Ivy League. There's two of them, one of them that you will definitely have heard of, but I'm not in a position to reveal who they are because they were on the left and they kind of got pushed out in part by Pappen and now don't consider themselves integralists anymore. When Pater Edmund, as he's often called, sort of started to import the ideas in a Facebook group and ultimately a Slack and Twitter, that's when things really got going in the U.S. But this was before Vermeule or Amari were even Catholic, much less integralist. And so, you know, early on, you know, it's Pater Edmund and the blog that started in 2014, the Josiahs, which were working out a lot of the ideas at a pretty high level, and they were very interested in the theory. And early on, I think this is one of the things that drew Papin, because, I mean, Papin's very, very smart and knows a lot of these details. And I think initially he was attracted to it, not for organizational reasons, but for reasons of religious conviction and intellectual interest. But I think he began to think that, wow, you know, this view really does have a lot of answers to contemporary issues. And I think once Trump got elected, it became clear that this was the time to move. And I think, you know, Pater Edmund was so busy with his duties as a Cistercian monk. Being a Cistercian is pretty demanding in terms of your daily duties. And he's all the way in Austria. He's also like a very, Pater Edmund is like a very, very like kind person. And I also think, like, I hope he won't mind me saying this, but like kind of politically naive, in a way, in the sense that, I think he like things like most people tend to mean pretty well. And I think when some of the more toxic stuff was developing, I just don't think he really saw it. I don't think this was any part of his intention. But yeah, when it started to get pretty reactionary and authoritarian, you know, like at the Josiahs or with the pro-Trump stuff or bringing all these new personalities in for Twitter, I think things got away from him to some extent. The sort of religious conviction part of integralism became less important than the American political project. And so by 2017, 2018, a lot of the religiosity has been eclipsed, but particularly by 2020, a lot of it has been eclipsed. And so, but the British integralists have been kind of left to the wayside and for a variety of interesting reasons. But one is that they were so interested in spiritual form that they were prepared to really criticize Pope Francis a lot. And the American integrals didn't want to do that. They felt it was impious and insubordinate. And I also think they thought it wasn't going to be strategically successful to criticize the hierarchy because they'd watch other traditionalists do that to no effect. And they didn't want their political movement to be condemned by the hierarchy because the last French integralist movement, Action Française, had been condemned by Pope Pius XI in 1924, almost exactly 100 years ago, which was very devastating for it. And I think they also don't want to get condemned. Because I think they can succeed as well as that is. And I also know that Papin thinks, much like Father Waldstein thought, that, you know, being too critical of the hierarchy is impious, and that there should be a tendency to defend the hierarchy and not to reflexively criticize them, but to reflectively defend them, and also to defend their privacy. So there's a really fascinating event a few years ago on Twitter where the Pillar, a sort of Catholic conservative magazine, exposed that the secretary of the U.S. Council of Catholic Bishops, I think it had been on Grindr or whatever on his phone, and Father James Martin, who's very much a figure on the American Catholic left, and Papin and Vermeule kind of teamed up to attack the Pillar, but for very different reasons. I mean, Father Martin was like, you know, don't expose, you know, people's private struggles. But I think for Papin and for Mule, that's insubordination, is to reveal that stuff. To embarrass the hierarchy is gravely sinful. It's a big problem. And so they'll even block people left and right, Catholics that they think are insufficiently subordinate, insufficiently obedient to the church.
I'm curious, you know, in all this as well, you mentioned kind of sticking with this American-European difference. Papin having been fond of Trump, and also he did this little I don't want to, provocation diminishes some of what it really was, but this Journal of American Greatness thing that was briefly in at the beginning of the sort of Trump moment, but I'm curious if, one, you could talk a little about that, but also how do the integralists elsewhere relate to the other figures in national politics and other places that have come to be, and granted, they are different from Trump, but have come to be associated with this moment, you know, your Le Pens and your Maloneys and your, obviously there's a lot of affection for Orban. In other places, what is the relationship like between the integralists and some of these figures?
Well, integralism isn't really very, very much of a phenomenon outside the United States and England, at least in terms of public figures. I have talked to some Dutch classical liberals that are pretty young, that are in contact with other people in kind of ideological circles in Europe. And they do say that there are some continental integralists, but none of them, as far as I know, have really made their mark in terms of being public in their advocacy. So almost everyone you're going to hear about is either British or American, or in Amari's case, Iranian American. So that's just kind of the situation. The Americans and the English do tend to welcome certain kinds of populist movements, but also recognize how fickle they can be. I mean, Maloney has not really governed as a populist. She's been much more of a normie kind of Italian conservative than you might have thought from her rhetoric, particularly her opposition to Putin. I mean, one of the things that marks out the new right is this unwillingness to be hostile to Putin and kind of like cagey criticism of Ukraine and stuff. And she's not really fooled with that at all. So the integralists, yeah, have really focused on Orban. He's the one. I mean, they tried to make some outreach to Poland, but it's really with Orban. They have the personal audiences, they get the funding from, they get the jobs from, and so on. So yeah, there's not a huge story to tell about the continental integralists yet. So most of the focus has been between the United States and Hungary and them engaging in a kind of ideological exchange. And I think one of their consistent daily prayers is probably that Orban will convert to Catholicism, because he's something of like a Calvinist slash Reformed Christian at present. So we will see. But Orban, having decisively won his last election compared to all the losses for the Trumpist candidates in the United States, I think has frustrated the integralists. I think they still kind of like Trump because of the way he's able to be unapologetically anti-woke, but they really prefer someone who has a kind of stable personality who can govern in a long-term way, which is one of the things they hoped that DeSantis would be, even though it looks like he's just got a lot of work to do in terms of training to be an effective communicator and so on. Not sure he can pick it up in the next year, but he's only 44. And so that gives him some time. So I think ultimately, one of the things the integralists are hoping with is that in time, they'll be able to have, in the coming decades, a pretty serious influence on the direction of the GOP. So
one thing I want to ask, that which is the whole premise of your book, both in your argument and just by existing, asserts, which is these ideas are important to wrestle with and to address and to confront. Because I think it would be easy for some people to say, well, what I'm hearing is a story of some kind of niche elites running around, getting some jobs at think tanks in Budapest. And yes, maybe a few of them waxing from places like Harvard. But these are also ideas that I think have to be, and why I like what you're doing, have to be addressed. And that there is the question, okay, of what it would look like if this could happen practically. And I think our conversation up to this point has clearly laid out how it would be authoritarian and anti-liberal and not particularly good. But there is also the question of just the ideas being dangerous by themselves, the ideas being corrosive by themselves, the ideas, the very fact that this kind of project exists, regardless of how close it is to reality, being a challenge that has to be dealt with and talked about for people of faith and for liberals in general. And I'm just interested more in your thoughts in that direction, because, it's not just about the practical sort of, and a group of people impose this system. It's that the ideas themselves are bad and dangerous.
Yes. Yeah. So, I mean, one of the things that happens, I think, in the United States is that the Catholic right really does exert intellectual influence over the right as a whole. And so what happens at the top on the right intellectually filters down. And this is something that the integralists know very well. It's one of the reasons that Vermeule wrote his book, Common Good Constitutionalism, in order to provide a sort of alternative to sort of limited government conservatism, which he thinks is a hopeless failure and ultimately a heretical doctrine. They're really focused on elite change, befriending senators. They're good buddies with J.D. Vance, for instance. And I think they're trying to build whatever connections they can with others. So at elite levels. And so the thought is that they can capture young Catholic minds. Their influence will grow very quickly over the next decade or two as those people assume positions of influence. So, Vermeule has written on the judiciary in order to explain, I think, the way in which post-liberals should think about the law and about interpreting the law. And I'm told his next book is going to be on a common good approach to the administrative state. So basically, he's like explaining to young people, hey, if you want to help with this movement, here's how to think about getting into the administrative state, and here's how to think about getting into the judiciary. I don't want to suggest that there's not really an independent intellectual project here, but it definitely serves the auxiliary purpose of giving young people a vision for how to influence things. And those visions could be quite consequential. So I'm told, for instance, at a number of prominent law schools that Vermeule has quite the following. It's still a minority, but it's not a tiny one. And I suspect in the next 30 years in the United States federal courts that there'll be a couple of judges that are common good constitutionalists. I'm not even kidding. I think there's, 100 or 200 law students probably between Chicago, Notre Dame, Harvard, and a few other places that are common good constitutionalists. If one of them ends up a federal judge at some point, that can really matter. So that's the way in which this stuff matters. It's less its core ideal and more the things that are kind of below its ideal. So
I think that's a lot of really, really, really good food for thought. I mean, I find this conversation so interesting. I think the book and the arguments, the analysis in it is fascinating. When I first started consuming your comments and other interviews on this stuff, it was just exciting to hear someone really going in on it, because I had kind of my introductory path to integralism was through the back door, right, by being more interested in Hungary and Orbán.
Yeah.
That obviously,
yes, you're very unusual in that regard, but yeah, it's been a cool angle. Yeah.
Yeah. But that obviously put me right into Papen and Dreher.
Yeah.
Who I've had very small interactions with, not much. Papen, who sort of very confusingly told me once that he liked what I'd written about Hungary, which I had no idea how to take. and Dreher being much more sort of not particularly fond at all. Not apologies to spring it, but this is the way we like to as a fun way in conversations, which is as a nod to our title of the show, The Periphery, and our kind of affection for heartland areas. We like to ask people, it can be where you are now, it can be some other place you were another time, but somewhere, and you're in Ohio now, off the beaten path, that if someone were to come to your place, whether it's a museum or a state park or just a food or history museum experience, that you would say, hey, if you happen to be coming through, if you're coming through to Bowling Green State to give a talk or go to a conference, and then you have a few extra hours, what should you do? What should they do?
The Toledo Art Museum. So one of the things that's important about this area of the country is that it's, post-industrial parts of Northwest Ohio and in Michigan. And back in the day, particularly after World War II, it's a central place for automobile manufacturing in a way that employed tons and tons and tons and tons of people, made a lot of people very rich and led them to establish a lot of really nice places, places to visit. I think the Toledo Zoo is actually surprisingly good. But the Toledo Art Museum, and there's a variety of places in Detroit, are really, really nice, things. Particularly, I would say actually, Detroit's Art Museum, I forget its name, is world class. So, and Detroit's about an hour north. So, I think Bowling Green is a college town of, 15 to 30,000 people, depending on what time of year it is. There's, we have like a nice nature trail that I really like that's near my house, but there's not a crazy amount to do, but Toledo is just 20 minutes north of us. So,
I appreciate that recommendation. My only knowledge at the moment of Toledo specifically is from being a fan of AP Bio, which and Toledo. Thank you so much, Dr. Kevin Valier. The book is All the Kingdoms of the World on Radical Religious Alternatives to Liberalism, and Dr. Valier is at Bowling Green State. And it was a pleasure to chat with you.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on.
The Periphery is a production of the Pulaski Institution. I've been your host, Alan Elrod. Our music was written, recorded, and produced by Brandon Ragsdale and Cody Smith. Thank you for coming, and please join us next time.